History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if people like you and me, well, if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always end up educated, we're entertained, and if we're listening in the right frame of mind, we sure can be inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week marks another important World War II anniversary, the day the globe could finally exhale after years of worldwide conflict. September 2nd, 1945 is when Imperial Japan agreed to unconditional surrender, signing the documents on the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay and officially bringing World War II to an end. The catastrophic loss of life around the world, the impact on truly everyone alive then, and by extension, all of us alive today, is really hard to fathom. On Wednesday, September 2nd, 2026, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. will host some of the few remaining World War II veterans to mark that anniversary. And we're going to prepare you for that today through the voices of a couple World War II vets, but later, the voices reverberating over these same radio airwaves 81 years ago, like General Douglas MacArthur and President Harry Truman. We begin with one of the veterans who was aboard the battleship Missouri for that historic moment. At the time, he was a newly released prisoner of war. But to understand why that moment 81 years ago meant so much to William Sanchez and to the rest of the world, let's go back to the day things took a turn in a very different direction for him. It was day one of what would become more than 1,200 days in captivity. He was on the island of Corregidor in Manila Bay, and as it became clear that that installation would be captured by the enemy, his orders were to make sure the flag flying at their outpost did not fall into Japanese hands.
We tried to preserve the flag itself so that it wouldn't fall into Japanese hands. We took the flag down and we hit it.
And it had been shot up a little bit, I guess, right?
It had a few shell shots on it, yes, quite a bit.
So did someone tell you to tear it into little pieces, or was that your idea?
No, it came about. I wouldn't say it was my idea, but it was the only thing we could think of. We tore it into little pieces so that it wouldn't fall into enemy hands. Once it was in little pieces, we just kept it. They wanted the flag in total, and they didn't have the chance to get it.
I'm just imagining, you know, obviously you're someone who signed up to defend your country, and now you're overseas in a very difficult situation defending your country, and now you're having to take apart the emblem of your country. Was that an emotional experience?
Yes, it was, but you had to accept it, and that's what we did.
Were there some tears during that process?
Yes, there was. Quite a few.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I believe that I heard you mention before or read about it, that you made a statement at the time as you're completing this task that you never asked for, that the situation presented to you, about hoping no one else ever had to do that, what you were doing.
That's right. It was a very bad experience. You can't forget that. You knew you were going to lose your freedom, so it was a hard thing to accept.
Did you ever think you were going to lose your life?
Yes, all the time. At any time, you figured this might be your last moment.
And when that surrender happened, you probably had no idea what to expect from the Japanese, right?
Right. We had no idea what was going to happen to us.
What did happen to you? What was the first thing they had you do?
Most of it was bad treatment and things that you don't really expect, but you have to endure.
And you were still a very young man.
I was a very young kid, yes.
You're in your early 20s. At this point, you're 23. Do you think that some of what you'd already endured in your life prepared you to handle that?
Yes. It was a good experience to be able to handle what was coming. And you don't wish it on other people.
So now you're a prisoner.
Yes.
And you have no idea how long you're going to be a prisoner.
That's the worst part.
So how did you face that? What gave you the strength or the hope to endure, to persist, to persevere?
Well, you never lose hope. You always think something better is going to happen. And you go on that basis. Things can't get worse.
But for you, as I understand your story, after you're a prisoner, they did get worse. The Japanese gave you a real brutal task.
The Japanese were real bad. It's something we had to learn to endure.
And they made you pile up all the bodies of the Americans and Filipinos who've been killed there?
Yes. They made us take care of all the bodies and everything, and we thought it would never end.
And then what did they do with those bodies that they forced you to gather?
Oh, they just piled them up, carted them up, and set fire to it. They weren't very kind. And all in all, it was a very bad experience. But it was something that had to be endured.
And so this is 1942. And as I said, you didn't know how long, but it was going to be a long time until you tasted freedom again.
Yes. It was a very difficult time at the time.
Can you help us understand what life in captivity was like and what some of the things you had to face and endure were?
It is very difficult to try to explain what we endured. It's unbelievable, but it happened.
Is it okay if I ask you a few questions about some of it?
Yes.
And I realize that this is something you had to survive one day at a time for more than 3 years.
You never knew what was going to happen the next day. From day to day, you learn to live life.
Were there some people that you were with that helped you?
We all helped each other. There was many bad things we had to learn to endure, and we all helped each other.
You know, one thing that I think most people listening can identify with or maybe can get a frame of reference from, since we all have to eat to survive, maybe people would be interested to hear what your menu consisted of as a prisoner of war.
Leftovers. What they didn't eat, they would feed us.
Is it fair to say that you ended up eating some things you never thought you'd eat?
That is true. It was a rough time in life that you don't even like to think about.
And we talked about you being a boxer, a good enough boxer that the Bruins wanted to give you a scholarship for it.
That's right.
So you're in pretty good physical shape before this happens.
Very good shape.
Uh-huh.
But that dwindled fast.
Yeah. So how much do you think you weighed before the war?
Oh, maybe 135 pounds or something. And we were down to about 100.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very difficult life overall and the way things happened.
And, you know, people today, some of the reference points they have to this experience, maybe one of the most well-known would be your friend Louis Zamperini, and they've seen the movie Unbroken or they've read that book by Laura Hillenbrand.
Yes.
Or read Louis' book.
Louis Zamperini happened to be in my camp, so I knew real well what he wrote about.
So when he wrote about being tortured?
Yes.
You experienced similar things?
Well, life itself was a torture, and it's just something you had to learn to endure.
How often did you think about your brother or your sister or your cousins, your family back here?
Quite often you think of what life is like to be with your family, yes.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war give me different perspectives on some of the things they did in captivity to focus their minds or to remain hopeful. Some guys would daydream about all the things they were going to eat when they got out or the business they were going to start.
You always think about that, what you're going to eat when you get out. That's the primary thought.
So what was that for you? Was there something you were really looking forward to?
No, I just learned to accept things as they were and hope for something better. You learn to take it on a day-by-day basis because you can never do any planning or anything. It's a day-to-day thing.
And what were some of the things that the Japanese required you to do?
Whenever they could, they'd put us to work, and we would have to do labor and things that we were not accustomed of doing.
And I imagine if you're not eating much, you don't have much strength either.
Your energy level is very low, so you just do the best you can.
And how would they react if one of you was unable to do what they asked you to do?
They would do many unpleasant things that would make it difficult you to enjoy life as a whole. It's a difficult life all around. Just to survive was important. So that's what you thought of the most. How am I going to survive all this?
Well, and I guess that's the biggest question. As we look to your example and we marvel at the fact that you're still here and still able to tell this story, the biggest question is, how did you survive? How'd you do it?
It's a mind over matter thing. You have to think positive that eventually it's gonna end.
We mentioned Louis Zamperini, and if people have read his book, they know about the deal he made with God when he was floating on the raft.
Yeah, I was in the same camp with Louis Zamperini. So I knew most of his thinking because he would talk about things. It was just a bad situation overall.
Had you known who he was because of his track days at USC?
Well, yes, I knew who he was, and I was real close to him. We were just in a bad situation overall, and it was something we could not control.
And people who have read his book or seen the movie, one of the characters that was a real-life character that they'll never forget after digesting that was a guy he called the Bird. I think you had another nickname for him,
well,
right?
Well, the Bird was the disciplinary officer, and he was in charge of discipline on all the prisoners.
And you called him the Wily Bird?
That's what we would named him, the Wily Bird.
Watanabe was his name.
He would always come up with things that were not too pleasant.
We got the sense from Louis' stories, and I had him on this program sharing his story, that the Bird almost seemed to enjoy picking on you American prisoners.
He preferred the American rather than the British and the other prisoners they had, because they felt they were overwhelmed by the Americans.
And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm just using that as a reference point because I know what Louis said about him, that he became the kind of figure that a lot of you prisoners would fear or would try to avoid if you could.
Well, you always tried to avoid the Japanese, especially the disciplinary officers. They were brutal.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can give us an example of that, of how they carried out that discipline.
Well, they wouldn't feed you if they felt they didn't have to, and it's just things that you don't expect. You expect a decent thing, and they do the reverse.
There's a well-known example that Louis told that is depicted in the film Unbroken, which you got to go to the premiere for with your son as a special guest. There's a scene in that film where they show Louis holding a railroad tie.
Yeah.
Did that really happen?
It actually happened. Yes, it did.
And is that something you were subjected to also?
Yes. We were all subjected to something of a kind. There was no exceptions.
And anybody who's seen that, just seen it depicted on film when it's not even really real, they can imagine and try to run through in their mind, how would I handle that? How would I try to survive that?
Yes. It is very difficult to imagine things that happen that are actually happening. You just learn to endure them.
Were there ever days where you woke up and felt, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
Many a day. How much longer do I have to do this?
And again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just wanting to understand how you really felt and what your experience was really like. But a situation like that, those circumstances that no one would ever choose, how does that affect your view of God or your feeling as to whether it's worthwhile to pray or if anyone's ever going to help you. Is that something that was relevant for you?
Sometimes you wonder if there's any help. It's very difficult to go through the things you have to endure because where do they come up with these ideas? It's not an easy life.
And I don't want to leave anything out that would be important to you, but one thing I'm sure that a lot of people would be interested in and hopefully is a little more pleasant memory for you. And I know there's a lot of things that happened over the time from the time you became a prisoner to when you were liberated. But help me understand what it was like when you guys started to realize, hey, the end is near and we may get to taste freedom again.
It's a very, very good feeling to think that you're going to have freedom again. Just the thought of it makes it exceptional. You always think the best is going to happen. You never think of the worst. It's always the best.
Where were you, and can you help me understand what it was like when that taste of freedom finally showed up again?
Oh, exhilarating. I was a prisoner in a prison camp when they finally decided to surrender. And boy, that was a great day.
How did you hear about it?
They let us know about it. That such and such is going to happen. And they made you aware of everything. So we were pretty much up to date on what is happening.
Did the Japanese treat you differently after that news?
Well, they had no power at all. The Americans took care of us and what our needs were. But it was a great feeling just to be free. It was just something you experience once in a lifetime, freedom. You realize what the word freedom really means.
And you've had a long time to look back on those days.
I would never want to go through it again.
And we certainly don't blame you. We wouldn't want to go through it either.
Life can be beautiful.
Well, I'm just wondering what kind of perspective your experience as a prisoner added to your life since then?
Well, you learn to look at things differently, and you never know what to expect. But there are difficult things in life that are going to happen, and you have to learn to accept them.
So when you got liberated, what was the first thing you wanted to do?
Have something good to eat.
What was it?
Well, anything. Something good. Just have a good feeling that you're eating something pleasant.
What was the worst thing you ever had to eat as a prisoner?
Oh, gosh. We ate mostly scraps, so there was nothing good about lunchtime. Things were tough, and we knew we had to endure them.
And before you came home, back to California, you actually ended up in a very unique place on September 2nd, 1945, 2.5 weeks or so after the Japanese declared their intent to surrender. They actually had some dignitaries that came aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay and signed the instruments of surrender.
Yes.
And we've seen the pictures. General MacArthur was there, and Admiral Nimitz was there, and this skinny General Wainwright was there.
All the big shots were there, yes. That was a happy day for all of us.
Well, and somebody else was there.
MacArthur.
How about Sanchez?
Yeah, I was right in the middle of things. But we were so grateful just to be free. It made all the difference in the world.
How did you end up on the Missouri that day for that ceremony?
They took us there. They made a special thing to take us to be present there at the Missouri. And we just accepted the occasion. It's good to be free.
So you took advantage of that freedom.
That's right.
When you came back to the States.
Yes.
Was there any thought in your mind about remaining in the Army and making it a career?
No. I wanted to get into life itself.
So you took advantage of the GI Bill.
Yes.
Went to college.
Went to college and accepted what I learned and took advantage of it.
You got to go back to Japan.
Yes, I did.
Not too long ago.
Yes.
With some other ex-prisoners of war.
That's right.
What were some of the things you got to do there, and what was it like for you all those years later?
Well, the one thing is you get treated so differently that you begin to wonder, where was all this happening? You know, it just makes things so different to go back and pay a visit. You wonder how it all could happen. It was a very difficult experience, and one that you will never forget. You wonder how one human can be as bad to another as it happened. It's so good to enjoy freedom. You don't realize it till you lose it.
A message echoed by so many ex-prisoners of war we've had the privilege of meeting over the years on Hometown Heroes. That's one of the men who was on the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay 81 years ago for the day when the guns went silent. As General MacArthur famously said, we're going to hear that speech before we're done. But if you want to see the document that was signed and even pens used to sign it, I can tell you one place that you can do that. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank, so the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As the world prepares to mark the 81st anniversary of the end of World War II, we're focusing on what happened September 2nd on the battleship USS Missouri, with Imperial Japan's unconditional surrender bringing World War II to a close. You can visit that historic ship itself and learn all about the surrender if you go to Hawaii. The Mighty Mo is just across Pearl Harbor from the USS Arizona Memorial. But if you want to see one of the only copies of the Instruments of Surrender, the document signed by American and Japanese officials that day, you might want to go to Pueblo, Colorado. One of their favorite all-time docents at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum was a man named Bill Barrett, who kept volunteering there well past his 100th birthday. Bill loved showing off the B-29 bomber there, but the first thing he showed me on my visit was a display capturing September 2nd, 1945, complete with a corncob pipe that belonged to General Douglas MacArthur.
So what are we looking at here, Bill?
This is an instrument of surrender from the World War II. The documents that were signed by the Americans and the Japanese on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Harbor. There's some pictures of the signing, and over here we have a pipe belonged to MacArthur and possibly his hat.
And these are the pens they actually used?
These are some pens that were actually used at the signing. They say that General Wainwright used one of these pens.
General Wainwright, like William Sanchez, who we heard from earlier, had been a prisoner of the Japanese for more than 3 years. Just imagine the emotions he felt signing that document as a free and physically much, much lighter man on September 2nd, 1945. And one of the reasons Bill Barrett enjoyed sharing that Instruments of Surrender display with visitors as much as he did was because it affected his life too. Every one of the 16.5 million Americans in uniform in World War II had a job to do. For Bill, it meant 3 years in the Pacific communicating important messages. One of his favorite photos was when he got to sit on the wing of record-breaking ace Dick Bong's P-38 when it visited his island. But when Bill wrote down his memoirs, he expressed a little perspective on what he and so many others did that can be helpful for the rest of us, too.
I was not wading the shore at Omaha Beach. I was not fighting the enemy across the fields and towns of France and Germany. I was not flying in an airplane bombing the cities of Europe, or flying a fighter plane escorting our bombers, or shooting down enemy planes. I was not fighting in the jungles of New Guinea or storming a beach of some island in the South Pacific. I was not one of the 400,000 that never made it back home. However, the 912 Signal Company I was assigned to had a significant role in the war in the South Pacific.
All right. You got us interested, Bill.
Yeah. And then here's something else that was written about us. I won't read this whole thing, but I'll read part of it.
All right.
The supply of the final equipment and the operation of communications for all the units of General George C. Kennedy's 5th Air Force in New Guinea was the mission of the 912 Signal Company. In conjunction with the 27th Air Depot Group, the organization was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for Outstanding Merited Service and Achievement during the Papuan Campaign. The model signal depot established by the 912 Signal Company at Port Moresby has become the criterion upon which all other Signal Corps units of the Far East Air Force have been set up. From the 13th of December 1942 to 25th of April 1945, when the unit left Port Moresby to set up a signal depot in the Netherlands New Indies, the 912 Signal Company has played a significant part in turning back the Japanese and in hoping to help make the eventual doom of the Japanese Empire.
So they said, you guys are the standard.
Yeah.
Your right. signal company. That's how they want them all to work.
That's right. The message we mostly sent was like the, well, take one of the units that worked on airplanes, and at the end of the day, they had to report on what progress they made, how soon that aircraft was going to be back flying condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then every unit more or less had to send back something they their report for the day to back to MacArthur's headquarters in Australia, and that was a part of our job to do that.
Speaking of MacArthur,
yeah.
I understand you got somewhat close to him on at least one occasion.
I got a picture of him, but never got very close. They wouldn't let us get close to him. But
where was that?
It was in New Guinea, at Port Moresby, the day he came up to decorate Bong for his achievement.
For most of us, Bill, we haven't lived through an air raid. We haven't been on a military base yeah. and heard the warning and try to figure out how in the world you're going to stay safe when you have no idea if these bombs are going to land anywhere near you.
Right.
How frequent was that you guys would have an air raid?
Well, I don't know how frequent, but they went on for about 8 months before they stopped.
And how do you know it's happening?
You usually hear a siren. We would be over the hill from the airstrip. We'd hear sirens, and then the lights would go on, the searchlights. And then eventually you could see it. When they pick up the planes, you could see the planes up in the air.
So this is nighttime.
Nighttime, yeah.
The planes are coming. The searchlights are going off. And where are you?
In a pup tent.
In a pup tent.
Well, at first. The very first night we got into Port Moresby, we had an air raid.
Very first night.
Very first night.
Welcome to Port Moresby,
yeah.
Bill.
Yeah. So all we could do was just stand there and look.
And what do you see?
We had set up our pup tent. Well, you see the planes in the searchlights.
You see bombs coming out of the planes?
You couldn't see them, no, but you could hear them after they hit.
How close did they hit to where you were?
Just over the hill at the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
One night later on, a plane did sneak in behind one of our airplanes and drop some bombs, and one of them landed in a theater area. And it just happened that the movie had been over for a few minutes, so there were a few kids still hanging around, and some of them were killed. In fact, we lost 3 kids from our outfit that night.
From your company?
From our company, yeah.
And a couple things here. So if it had been 5 minutes earlier, you would have lost a lot.
Lost a lot of people, yeah.
Were you in the theater?
No, I did not go that night.
Did you usually go?
I went to a lot of theaters because that's about the only thing there was to do at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why
and
didn't you go that night?
I have no idea. I might have been working.
It's possible
I could have been working that night.
And the young men who were killed, did you know any of them?
I know all 3 of them because they were in my communications.
So you'd spent quite a lot of time with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was that for you to deal with?
It was pretty hard to miss them. Especially one of them in particular was a very intelligent gentleman, very nice gentleman, and had a lot of stories to tell. And he was really a character, and everybody enjoyed him, and we really missed him.
Did that kind of change the tenor of your company after that?
I don't think so, no.
Did you ever feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me too?
That's possible, very possible, yeah.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, you take it as it came. If you got hit, you got hit.
So obviously that was the closest.
That was the closest I ever came in.
Did you have a sense that the war was drawing to an end?
Oh, we knew it was over. In fact, the day I left Okinawa to go back to my unit, General MacArthur flew out of the same airstrip that I was at to go sign the peace treaty.
Well, speaking of other milestone moments, you know, I see a note here in the journal that you kept, basically, about finding out that President Roosevelt had died. Was that a message that you guys had come to your station?
Yes, yeah.
How did that hit you?
Pretty hard. He did a lot during the war for the communities and the country and the states, and I'm glad they kept him on all during the war instead of changing during the war.
I'm sure you had heard him on the radio on December 8th. Huh?
Oh, yeah.
And again, looking at the notes that you've put together, July of 1945, you've got a note here that says, "The last letter from home informed me that both my mom and dad were in the hospital. I did not know what was wrong with my mom, but dad had been hurt helping someone move a piano. I didn't hear another word for 2 weeks." How hard was that?
It was pretty rough. But I knew something had happened to one of them. because I didn't hear anymore.
So
my girlfriend quit writing to me, family quit writing to me. And the reason they did, because the guy that's in charge of the Red Cross there said, oh, he'll get to come home. All we have to do is let him know he'll get to come home. So don't, but I didn't.
You didn't get to come home.
Didn't get to come home.
And after all that waiting on pins and needles and that hopeless feeling of not knowing and having no way to find out, you finally got really bad news.
I got the news from a chaplain that called one night and wanted to talk to me. He wouldn't tell me anything over the phone. So I went to see him, and he told me that my mother had passed away. But it wasn't no big surprise because I knew something had happened to one of them.
You'd prepared yourself
for that. I kind of prepared for it, yeah. But it was tough coming home and not having my mother there.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah.
And here, you've been out there for 3 years in the Pacific, living in a tent.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some of the summers must have just been really brutally hot.
Hot and rainy seasons and stuff. And, yeah.
It's not a very comfortable existence.
Oh, no, no.
And the same week that Japan surrenders and there's so much to celebrate, you get this horrible news that your mother has died.
Yeah, she passed away on August 5th, and I think the war was over about that same time, if I remember right.
About 10 days later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they knew that it was coming to an end at that time back in the States.
Was there some celebration out where you were when you guys got that news that Japan had surrendered?
Quite a bit. A lot of guys were shooting off their guns and had fire. I don't know where they got fireworks, but some of them had fireworks and stuff. I have no idea where they came from. Mostly with guns going off and guys hollering, and both when Japan surrendered and when Germany surrendered. Same thing.
How excited were you to come home?
Really excited. You'll never know how excited you are to get it. Discharged and get to come home and see your family and your girlfriend. That was the highlight of my Army career, I think.
Well, tell me about that moment. How did that all unfold?
I was discharged in Denver, and I came home on Rock Island Rocket, which is a train that came through my hometown. And my dad and my little sister, my girlfriend, and I don't know, 8 or 10, 12 of my friends are all there to greet me. It was a great time to see all of them and get to hug my girlfriend and get a kiss her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't have that experience.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of them never came home.
Some, even if they did, 3 years is a long time to wait for a boyfriend.
Well, that's true. A lot of them got Dear John letters.
I'm sure there were some guys in Belleville that had eyes on Lillian.
Well, yeah, I'm sure of that.
So how long did you wait to pop the question?
I'm not sure how soon we talked about it, but we were married less than a month later.
Less than a month after you got home?
We were married on December 2nd.
Wow. Yeah. And when'd you get home?
November the 8th.
So you wait all of a month to get married to Lillian after she's waited for you to get home for 3 years. You guys go on to have a couple sons. You've got a couple granddaughters. You ever think about what if? What if you were in the theater that night? What if you were one of those more than 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
Yeah. What if I never made it home? Well, there wouldn't be two great boys, two great granddaughters.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
Well, makes me feel pretty proud of all my family.
Have you been back to Washington and the National World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes. I got on that honor flight.
Uh-huh.
That they have. Are you familiar with that?
Very.
Okay. I went with that with my brother. He and I went together.
You and your brother got to go together.
On the honor flight, out of Denver.
How much trouble did you guys cause?
I don't know. He was in a wheelchair most of the time. He was getting along. He was 2 years older than I was.
Tell me about that experience. What'd you get out of it?
Oh, it's a great experience for me, especially being with him. Meant a lot to me, seeing it together.
And I know you tend to downplay your time in the war, even though you were overseas a lot longer than most World War II veterans.
That's true, yeah.
Did that honor flight experience, the way people treated you in D.C., the way they treated you back here in Colorado when you came back, did that give you a new perspective on what you had done and what it meant to people?
Well, not really. You know, I feel what I did was necessary. It had to be done. But I feel sorry for all those guys that were in the infantry and fighting and all that kind of stuff. And with what they did and what I did, I don't think I did too much. That's my feelings.
Well, I've heard a lot of guys say that to me. But but the rest of us know that we wouldn't be here without you.
Yeah, that's
your
true.
Sons wouldn't have been born, for sure, if you didn't come home.
Yeah.
The world would be a much different place.
That's true.
If you hadn't done what you did.
Yeah.
That memorial itself, when you look at all those gold stars,
what
comes to mind? What'd you think about when you were looking at that?
Well, you feel sorry for them that didn't make it back home.
Were there any moments of that trip back to D.C. that kind of stand out for you that were real impressive or meant something to you?
Yes. They had Europe on one side, the Pacific on the other side, and they had the one named New Guinea
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in New Guinea, so I got down beside it and had my son take a picture of me with the New Guinean right beside me. That might have been one of my highlights.
I bet when you're here in this gift shop, you get some opportunities to talk to people who certainly weren't alive when World War II was happening.
Right, yeah.
What's the most important thing that you think people need to know about what happened, about the young men and women that served our country during that time?
Well, I think they need to think about the people that never made it back home. They need to think about the people that served.
And Bill Barrett kept on serving till his final breath. 81 years ago this week, he and the rest of the world were breathing a sigh of relief and wondering what this new post-war world would look like. You heard about Bill's Honor Flight experience, and the flying season for the Honor Flight Network is revving up again. You should go to honorflight.org if you haven't before, honorflight.org, to connect to a local effort near you. And if you live near me in Central California, you can join us actually on the 81st anniversary of the end of World War II, Wednesday, September 2nd. At the Fresno Yosemite International Airport, you can welcome home 68 veterans, mostly from the Vietnam era, but many who had fathers serving in World War II, and they know they might not have been born if things went a little differently 81 years ago. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, what you would have heard on some of these very same radio stations 81 years ago, President Truman, General MacArthur, Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the anniversary of the official end of World War II, September 2nd, 1945. You can watch a live stream from the National World War II Memorial on September 2nd, as that is observed, and the Friends of the National World War II Memorial archive all of those videos on their website, if you ever have time to take a look. Perhaps the President of the United States will have something to say for the occasion, but 81 years ago, here's how President Harry Truman addressed the nation.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest. It was a long road to Tokyo and a bloody one. We shall not forget Pearl Harbor. The Japanese militarists will not forget the USS Missouri. The evil done by the Japanese warlords can never be repaired or forgotten. But their power to destroy and kill has been taken from them. Their armies, and what is left of their navy, are now impotent. To all of us, there comes first a sense of gratitude to Almighty God, who sustained us and our allies in the dark days of grave danger, who made us to grow from weakness into the strongest fighting force in history, and who has now seen us overcome the forces of tyranny that sought to destroy his civilization. God grant that in our pride of this hour, we may not forget the hard tasks that are still before us, that we may approach these with the same courage, zeal, and patience with which we faced the trials and problems of the past 4 years. Our first thoughts, of course, thoughts of gratefulness and deep obligation, go out to those of our loved ones who have been killed or maimed in this terrible war. On land and sea and in the air, American men and women have given their lives so that this day of ultimate victory might come and assure the survival of a civilized world. No victory can make good their loss. We think of those whom death in this war has hurt, taking from them fathers, husbands, sons, brothers and sisters whom they love. No victory can bring back the faces they long to see. Only the knowledge that the victory, which these sacrifices have made possible, will be wisely used, can give them any comfort. It is our responsibility, ours, the living, to see to it that this victory shall be a monument worthy of the dead who died to win it. All millions of men and women in our armed forces and merchant marines all over the world who, after years of sacrifice and hardship and peril, have been spared by Providence from harm. We think of all the men and women and children who, during these years, have carried on at home in lonesomeness and anxiety and fear. Our thoughts go out to the millions of American workers and businessmen, to our farmers and miners, to all those who have built up this country's fighting strength and who have shipped to our allies the means to resist and overcome the enemy. Our thoughts go out to our civil servants and to the thousands of Americans who, at personal sacrifice, have come to serve in our government during these trying years, to the members of the Selective Service Boards and Ration Boards, to the Civilian Defense and Red Cross workers, to the men and women in the USO and in the entertainment world, to all those who have helped in this cooperative struggle to preserve liberty and decency in the world. We think of our departed gallant leader, Franklin D. Roosevelt, defender of democracy, architect of world peace and cooperation. And our thoughts go out to our gallant allies in this war, to those who resisted the invaders, to those who were not strong enough to hold out, but who, nevertheless, kept the fires of resistance alive within the souls of their people, to those who stood up against great odds and held the line until the United Nations together were able to supply the arms and the men with which to overcome the forces of evil. This is a victory of more than arms alone. This is a victory of liberty over tyranny. From our war plants rolled the tanks and planes which blasted their way to the heart of our enemy. From our shipyards sprang the ships which bridged all the oceans of the world for our weapons and supplies. From our farms came the food and fiber for our armies and navies and for our allies in all the corners of the earth. From our mines and factories came the raw materials and the finished products which gave us the equipment to overcome our enemy. But back of it all were the will and spirit and determination of a free people who know what freedom is and who know that it is worth whatever price they had to pay to preserve it. It was the spirit of liberty which gave us our armed strength and which made our men invincible in battle. We now know that that spirit of liberty, the freedom of the individual, and the personal dignity of man are the strongest and toughest and most enduring forces in all the world. And so on VJ Day, we take renewed faith and pride in our own way of life. We have had our day of rejoicing over this victory. We have had our day of prayer and devotion. Now let us set aside VJ Day as one of renewed consecration to the principles which have made us the strongest nation on earth and which, in this war, we have striven so mightily to preserve. Those principles provide the faith, the hope, and the opportunity which help men to improve themselves and their lot. Liberty does not make all men perfect, nor all society secure, but it has provided more solid progress and happiness and decency for more people than any other philosophy of government in history. And this day has shown again that it provides the greatest strength and the greatest power which man has ever reached. We know that under it we can meet the hard problems of peace which have come upon us. A free people with free allies who can develop an atomic bomb can use the same skill and energy and determination to overcome all the difficulties ahead. Victory always has its burdens and its responsibilities as well as its rejoicing. But we face the future and all its dangers with great confidence and great hope. America can build for itself a future of employment and security. Together with the United Nations, it can build a world of peace founded on justice, fair dealing, and tolerance. As President of the United States, I proclaim Sunday, September the 2nd, 1945, to be VJ Day, the day of the formal surrender of Japan. It is not yet the day for the formal proclamation of the end of the war, nor of the cessation of hostility. But it is a day which we Americans shall always remember as a day of retribution, as we remember that other day, the day of infamy. From this day, we move forward. We move toward a new era of security at home. With the other United Nations, we move toward a new and better world of cooperation, of peace, and international goodwill. God's help has brought us to this day of victory. With His help, we will attain that peace and prosperity for ourselves and all the world in the years ahead.
The years ahead have added up to 81 and counting, but we can't conclude this special edition of Hometown Heroes without hearing the most famous words uttered on September 2nd, 1945. Standing in front of a microphone on the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay 81 years ago this week, General Douglas MacArthur delivered one of his most famous speeches, adding poignant captions to a day some weren't sure would ever come.
My fellow countrymen, today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed. And in reporting this to you, the people, I speak for the thousands of silent lips forever stilled among the jungles and the beaches and in the deep waters of the Pacific, which mark the way. I speak for the unnamed brave millions homeward bound to take up the challenge of that future which they did so much to salvage from the brink of disaster. As I look back on the long, tortuous trail from those grim days of Bataan and Corregidor, when an entire world lived in fear, when democracy was on the defensive everywhere, when modern civilization trembled in the balance, I thank a merciful God that He has given us the faith, the courage, and the power from which to mold victory. We have known the bitterness of defeat and the exaltation of triumph, and from both we have learned there can be no turning back. We must go forward to preserve in peace what we won in war. A new era is upon us. Even the lesson of victory itself brings it profound concern, both for our future security and the survival of civilization. The destructiveness of the war potential through progressive advances in scientific discovery has, in fact, now reached a point which revises the traditional concept of war. Men, since the beginning of time, have sought peace. Various methods through the ages have been attempted to devise an international process to prevent or settle disputes between nations. From the very start, workable methods were found insofar as individual citizens were concerned. But the mechanics of an instrumentality of larger international scope have never been successful. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blots out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we do not devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon will be at our door. The problem, basically, is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescence and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advance in science, art, literature,
and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. We stand in Tokyo today, reminiscent of our countryman, Commodore Perry, 92 years ago. His purpose was to bring to Japan an era of enlightenment and progress by lifting the veil of isolation to the friendship, trade, and commerce of the world. But alas, the knowledge thereby gained of Western science was forged into an instrument of oppression and human enslavement. Freedom of expression, freedom of action, even the freedom of thought were denied through suppression of liberal education, through appeal to superstition, and through the application of force. We are committed by the Potsdam Declaration of Principles to see that the Japanese people are liberated from this condition of slavery. It is my purpose to implement this commitment just as rapidly as the armed forces are demobilized and other essential steps taken to neutralize the war potential. The energy of the Japanese race, if properly directed, will enable expansion vertically rather than horizontally. If the talents of the race are turned into constructive channels, the country can lift itself from its present deplorable state into a position of dignity. To the Pacific Basin has come the vista of a new emancipated world. Today, freedom is on the offensive. Democracy is on the march. Today, in Asia as well as in Europe, unshackled peoples are tasting the full sweetness of liberty, the relief from fear. In the Philippines, America has evolved a model for this new free world of Asia. In the Philippines, America has demonstrated that peoples of the East and peoples of the West may walk side by side in mutual respect and with mutual benefit. The history of our sovereignty there has now the full confidence of the East. And so, my fellow countrymen, today I report to you that your sons and daughters have served you well and faithfully with the calm, deliberate, determined fighting spirit of the American soldier and sailor, based upon a tradition of historical trait as against the fanaticism of an enemy supported only by mythological fiction. Their spiritual strength and power has brought us through to victory. They are homeward bound. Take care of them.
That was General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers.
It sure was. You can see his corncob pipe in Colorado, visit his museum in Virginia, or another one honoring his legacy where he was born in Arkansas. But there's nothing like hearing the words of General MacArthur himself to make you feel like you were there. And some of you were. For the rest of us, we all have a little more perspective now on why the date September 2nd is so meaningful. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.